Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Remember the Holiday Inn. That could, in the end, be the rallying cry for a group of 51 rebellious Texas Democrats who are still holed up at a hotel in Oklahoma, refusing to return to the Lone Star State, where they face certain defeat on a vote for a congressional redistricting plan. The drama has been playing out over the last couple of days with talk of arrests and accusations of political power grabbing and more. Ken Herman is a staff reporter for the Austin American Statesman newspaper. Ken, how big is this story in Texas?
It's a big story. Obviously, our legislature here meets only for 140 days every other year, and it goes largely ignored except by the people who really care about this stuff. This one obviously has caught the public fancy because it is out of the ordinary.
What is going on? Tell us what each side is saying.
Both sides, because it is Texas, are indeed using the analogy and likening themselves to the heroes of the Alamo. The Democrats say they are using a legitimate parliamentary procedure to break a quorum by leaving the state and blocking a vote on something they would certainly lose. The Republicans who control this state, including our Governor Rick Perry, say no, they are just sore losers, basically, who refuse to show up and do the job they were elected to do.
And why are they so against the bill, which is a redistricting plan?
They are against it for the very simple reason that it would give Republicans more seats in Congress. Right now, Texas has 32 members of Congress, 17 Democrats, 15 Republicans. There is nothing else in this state that is a Democratic majority. Republicans hold all 27 statewide offices. They control both chambers of the legislature. And the Republican spin is there's no reason for this state to have a Democratic majority in Congress. The current lines were drawn in 2001 by a court after the legislature failed to agree on a plan after the 2000 census. So we're now operating under a court-ordered plan that continued the plan that had been drawn by Democrats way back in 1991.
Now, Democrats are blaming U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay for this redistricting plan. Why?
Because he has been hands-on involved in the effort with the Republicans. He was down here last week meeting with the House Republican caucus. He was standing in front of a map, pointing to it and smiling and drawing applause from the people on hand, and he has not denied that he's involved. He says rightfully involved. What's more important to him than getting more votes for his team in Congress? And the only thing more important than that might be getting them from his very own home state of Texas.
Yeah. Now, the House rules in Texas allow for the arrests of lawmakers who intentionally thwart a quorum, but Texas troopers have no authority to do anything in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma authorities have said they're loving this. They welcome the Democrats with open arms. And crazy as this seems, we hear this isn't unprecedented in Texas politics.
A similar incident in 1979, much smaller scale, a group called the Killer Bees at the time, was a group of senators who walked out of our 31-member Senate and prevented action on what was then action on a presidential primary bill. But the scope of this and the other bills this is killing as we come down to the end of our session and important deadlines that begin kicking in as early as Thursday, the scope of this is unprecedented. And, you know, what we have here is a bunch of Democratic legislators who have found they are more powerful by being gone than when they are here. And we have indeed set up sort of the Democratic capital of Texas is now in Ardmore, Oklahoma.
And mention again, what are the deadlines?
Tomorrow is the last day for the House to consider House bills. After that, they can only consider Senate bills and some other forms of legislation. But it's a big night. They would have been in session till midnight just churning the bills out, important, unimportant, because they start dying tomorrow night.
And there are other bills that will be held up, not just
everything. We have not, the only bill they ever have to pass, the state budget, has not been completed yet. The state faces a projected $9.9 billion deficit for the next two-year budget cycle. There is tort reform going on, homeowners insurance legislation. It's a big year of important legislation, and unfortunately for the people involved, this has become the most partisan moment in the history of the Texas legislature.
Mm. Ken Herman, thank you.
I'm glad to be here.
Ken Herman, reporter for the Austin American Statesman newspaper. Well, one of the 51 Democrats hiding out in Oklahoma is Representative Dan Ellis. He joins us on the line from the Holiday Inn in Ardmore. Welcome, Representative Ellis.
Hello. How are you today?
Well, I'm fine. Question is, how are you? What are you doing?
Well, we are proceeding with business to a large degree. We are meeting in normal caucus meetings just like we typically would if we were there. We're writing amendments to bills that we know will be on the calendar when we get back to Austin. We're handling constituent problems, working with the people back in our district and our state offices, and we're continuing business.
Well, you know, because that would be the first question people would have. There's an assumption that state business isn't getting done, and some people would say that's not fair.
Well, the state legislature is definitely slowed down right now. At least the House chamber is.
I'll say.
But most of the hard-pressing issues that were before the legislature are either in, at this stage in the game, either in conference committee or they are over in the Senate waiting on Senate approval. The work that's left to be done, when we get back, we'll be able to take care of.
Well, when will you get back? Do you see any sign of a compromise?
Our plans are right now that we will be back Friday, and that is initiated by a constitutional deadline that sets forth Thursday at midnight, in which no new House legislation can be taken up. So we will be back there Friday, but a telephone call from the Speaker of the House right now saying we will not take up redistricting, we promise you that, we would be loaded up on the bus and headed that way in 15 minutes, I assure you.
Well, you know, some would say that this is sort of a reverse hostage-taking, and doesn't this set a dangerous precedent for how government business might be carried out? Large groups of people just take off to a neighboring state whenever they don't like pending legislation.
Well, it does set a precedent, but we are willing to guarantee the Speaker of the House that we will not do this again. We have stood and we have fought against issues that were dear to our heart, and we have worked the process on those issues. This was one that we felt like we just absolutely could not allow to occur. Our rules in our House allow for the breaking of the quorum, and we explored all the possibilities, and this was the last tool that was left in the toolbox.
Yeah. Your colleagues have sent a message to Tom DeLay, but what about a message to President Bush, former Texan, a governor who was said to have very good relations with Democrats?
Well, I would like to think that President Bush isn't behind this, and he was very, very nonpartisan when he was in Texas, and so I would like to believe that it didn't start with him, or that, you know, that he is not pushing it in any way, shape, or form. The situation that we find ourselves in is this good for state government that every time there is a power change from one party to the other, for the new party to be able to say, hey, we don't like the way numbers are going. We don't like the number of congressmen we got. We're going to redraw lines, and we're going to reestablish those lines in such a way that we get control of Congress. If we allow this to happen once, it will happen every time there is a power shift, whether it is Republicans or Democrats.
Representative Ellis, one last question. We began by saying that your rallying cry when this is all over could be, remember the Holiday Inn. Well, Texans who made the last stand at the Alamo lost that battle but won the war. Briefly, how do you think you're going to fare? Win the battle, win the war, or lose both?
I hope that we win the battle. We may end up losing the war at some point in time. I know that in my particular case with this congressional redistricting, my district will lose. I represent a very rural district. We are being put in a district that would be controlled by part of downtown Houston. And the way the numbers are, the congressman would be elected from the metropolitan suburbs area of Houston. A congressman from Houston cannot understand the issues that my farmers, my timber growers, and they cannot understand those issues, and they're not going to be as willing to fight for federal highway dollars and state highway dollars and the other issues that affect us with health care, with education. I mean, it's a very important issue that we maintain representatives, we maintain congressmen who understand what's important to us and understand the issues that affect us.
Well, Representative Ellis, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dan Ellis, one of 51 Texas Democrats, holed up in the Holiday Inn in Oklahoma to try to prevent a redistricting vote.
The faculty of Baghdad University elected new deans and a new president today under the U.S. Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance. One small step on the long road to establishing a new Iraqi administration, free of Saddam loyalists. The American responsible for Iraq's Ministry of Higher Education and Scientific Research is Drew Erdman. Mr. Erdman joins us now on the line from Baghdad. Welcome, Drew.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. An election at Baghdad University today, an important step. When will Iraq's universities actually open again?
Iraq's universities are going to open up on May 17th. Some of the institutions have already started and are back to work. It depended on what damage they suffered. But the decision was made that every institution, no matter what, would open May 17th so that the academic year could be completed in every institution.
Wow. How do you complete an academic year with such intermittent electricity and phones?
Well, it is a challenge, and they're doing such things as, for example, if laboratory equipment has been damaged, they're adjusting their curriculum to use more lectures and more examinations to get people through the courses. So they're adapting, they're using what they have, they're using their experience, and I'm sure that they will succeed.
Now, these are universities that would have been run by Saddam loyalists until very recently. How are you dealing with that problem? Who can you find to really run an administration?
The way that we're proceeding with institutions of higher education is that till the end of the year, the faculties themselves will put forward people that they believe should govern them or administer on a day-to-day basis through the end of the year. And then, of course, we check to make sure that the people that they're putting forward meet essential coalition policy objectives.
How do you check whether someone recommended to you has a past that you find acceptable?
You know, for example, some of these individuals, number one, are quite public figures. In some cases, in, for example, the administration of science, we're not going to work with anyone who was working high in the WMD program. Well, quite frankly, we pass those names and we check them against our databases.
The simple human dynamics of all this must be very delicate. You're an American from Harvard. You're there in Iraq. You don't speak the language. We read about a physician who was appointed to lead the rebuilding of Iraq's health ministry resigning after he refused the demand of his U.S. supervisor to renounce the Ba'ath Party of former President Saddam Hussein. Tension between you and some Iraqis, there must be complicated human dynamics in all this.
There are complicated human dynamics. I mean, across the board, this is a society in transition. It's gone through an upheaval that is shaking society to the core. So this will be a long, interesting story.
You know, Drew, we're getting a pretty dark picture about how things are going over there in Baghdad. The crime, the looting, the lack of electricity, the lack of water, the lack of gasoline. You seem to be painting a more optimistic picture about the university system opening up again in just a matter of days.
I am optimistic in the long term, but look, I'm very realistic in the short term. All the issues that you highlighted are real challenges. The security issue is fundamental across the board. The issue of communications has been extraordinarily difficult in what we're doing in higher education. But the good story is that, you know, students want to get back to the classroom. Professors want to be able to teach. People are really optimistic looking to the long term in higher education here.
Drew, let me ask you finally, how long do you think ORHA, the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Iraq, will have to be there?
Well, I think that that's a long-term mission. I work with people who are involved in the justice sector and in police and law enforcement sectors. They're part of ORHA, but what they're laying the foundation for is programs that are going to take years to fully develop.
Drew Erdman, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Drew Erdman, cautiously optimistic about reopening and rebuilding the university system in Iraq. He's with the U.S. Office of Humanitarian and Reconstruction Assistance in Iraq.
Still to come, Caroline Kennedy's big new book on patriotism.
And a delicacy known somewhat indelicately as a fiddlehead.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. FBI agents are headed to Saudi Arabia to help in the investigation of the terrorist attacks thought to be the work of al-Qaeda. For more on this story, go to our website, WBUR.org, and click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Newman School, a small co-ed college prep school in the Back Bay. Applications still being accepted for fall 2003 on the web at NewmanBoston.org. By the Harvard Bookstore and Harvard.com, chosen Boston Magazine's Best of Boston 2002 for their selection of new, used, and remaindered books, Harvard Square's landmark literary and scholarly bookstore. And by Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event, catering menus available at 617-666-4366. In the forecast, partly cloudy today, topping out at about 63, mostly cloudy tonight, and tomorrow looks partly sunny and breezy with highs near 63. 61 degrees in Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Editor Caroline Kennedy's new compilation is called The Patriot's Handbook, Songs, Poems, Stories, and Speeches Celebrating the Land We Love. And it includes everything from Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi to George W. Bush's Address on Terrorism Before a Joint Meeting of Congress. In the book, patriotism has many meanings. Caroline herself supported the war in Iraq, but the anti-war anthem, Blowin' in the Wind, it's in the book. And Caroline joins us in the studio to talk about this huge undertaking. Hello.
Hello.
And welcome back.
Thank you so much.
The last time you were here was shortly after the events of 9/11, and you were speaking then about the collection of poetry you put together called The Best Loved Poems of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, your mother. And at that time, you told us that that poetry got you to thinking about patriotism.
Well, it did. Obviously, I grew up, you know, with poetry and also with history. It was something that both my parents loved and really brought alive for us. My grandmother, through her, you know, reciting Paul Revere's Ride and sort of passing on the belief that one person could change the course of history, I think really made it an exciting topic, especially in the last couple of years when people have thought much more about what it means to be an American. It was really something that that I wanted to share, and it brought me back to rereading some of the things that I had always had meant a lot to me and my children were now being introduced to, as well as, you know, new things that I thought, the ideas that really shaped our democracy.
So how did you do this? I mean, I know as an editor you have staff and you work with different people, but...
Well, you'd be surprised, because really this was really me. So...
Did you know all of this work?
Well, I knew a lot of it, and then when my friends and, you know, once I got into it, people really, you know, started suggesting things.
But still, not a lot of Americans are walking around with knowledge of Jeanette Rankin's speech in Congress on women's rights and wartime service in January of 1918.
No, they're not. But like I said, this is something I grew up with. And Jeanette Rankin was the only person to vote against both World War I and World War II. So she was someone that my father had thought about writing an article about as a profile in courage. And at that time, there were, you know, hardly any women in government. She was the only person to vote against World War II. And that was the end of that. And she was defeated in a bid for re-election. So she's a very interesting person and an interesting female politician.
That was not a test, but if it had been, you would have passed. You had mentioned your grandmother Rose reciting Paul Revere's Ride, and I had read that you were actually, the children were required to recite it when you went to Grandma's house.
Well, it was kind of a group effort, since it's a rather long poem. Everybody kind of, you know, knows a section, but nobody seems to know it all, except for maybe my Uncle Teddy, you know, singing songs on the 4th of July, and all those family activities. I think it's very entwined with family.
There are four speeches from your dad, and then other Kennedys are represented as well, two speeches each from your uncles. But it would be hard for you to do a book and not do that, I would imagine.
Well, actually, yeah, there's a lot more speeches of theirs that could easily be in. Ronald Reagan is very well represented, I would like to to point out as well. All the other living presidents are, too. I think, obviously, this is my, you know, my selection, and I think that both, you know, my Uncle Teddy, obviously, is still serving, and Uncle Bobby's speeches really are so powerful. My father's are the most familiar to me, but... You know, so I was really proud to be able to include those.
As I said, you included four. And the one we'd like to just listen to a little bit is the Address to the Nation on Civil Rights. What year was this?
1963.
Today we are committed to a worldwide struggle to promote and protect the rights of all who wish to be free.
It's right in there with Irving Berlin's God Bless America and Paul Simon. Him as well. The Grateful Dead?
The Beach Boys.
Why the Grateful Dead?
Well, they have the song U.S. Blues, and so I thought it would go well in the flag section because it's all about waving the flag, and it's kind of a good juxtaposition to some of the other flag-waving kinds of activities that are described.
This book on patriotism comes at a time when the word patriot has really been bandied about quite a bit. I was thinking, you know, the Patriot Missiles, the Patriot Act. And it's also been a divisive word. You know, people who questioned the war in Iraq were called unpatriotic. What's your definition of a patriot? And are there people in here who might have been thought of as being unpatriotic?
I think that there are people in there who take a very different look at patriotism. Mark Twain, for example, has an essay that's pretty biting about the kind of jingoistic sorts of activities and patriotism that was going on around the time of the Spanish-American War. Frederick Douglass says, you know, I'm a true lover of my country if I do not rebuke or excuse its sins. And I think that that's such an important part of American patriotism is the right to express your opinions, to respect the opinion of others, and we have another value, of course, which is tolerance. So those are always, I think, working themselves out. I think for me, patriotism is really much broader than that. I think it does have an emotional component. Everybody would, you know, define it for themselves, but I think it's, you know, we are tremendously fortunate. This is the greatest country on earth, and I think it comes with a sense of responsibility as well as a pride in our heritage, and that responsibility has to do with making sure that we know and appreciate the values that we're that our country is founded on, and that we do our best to try to participate and give back.
It's funny. You come from, you know, some would say the first family of Democrats, and there are different people who feel that they claim, or their party claims, or their point of view claims patriotism, and might even be surprised to learn that, well, Democrats sit around and sing songs about patriotism, about the country, because we're, again, to get back to that divisiveness, we're told that they don't.
Well, that was something that I absolutely didn't expect. And since this book has come out, it's really been the biggest, you know, surprise that I have even been asked that question, because, you know, people have said, are you trying to, like, reclaim patriotism? And I'm thinking, that just makes absolutely no sense to me at all. But sure,
Because you didn't know it had been taken away?
Absolutely. I think it obviously belongs to everybody. And I think it's really one of the great things about our country is the freedom of expression and the respect for others. And so if we have lost that, that is a bad thing. And so hopefully this book might play a small part in helping to remind people.
Well, thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
Caroline Kennedy, editor of the new book, A Patriot's Handbook, Songs, Poems, Stories, and Speeches Celebrating the Land We Love.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, the woman who heads the American Islamic Congress talks about the future for women in a post-Saddam Iraq.
Also, your Serenity poems. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by North Shore Magnetic Imaging Center, providing MRI services for over 15 years, locations in Peabody, Beverly, and Salem, on the web at nsmic.org. By techfusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. And the Elliott Hotel and Restaurant Clio, offering spring and summer packages of luxury suites with European service overlooking Commonwealth Avenue, ElliottHotel.com. On behalf of everyone here at WBUR, thanks for making a contribution during our Mother's Day fundraiser. It's your support that makes it possible for us to keep bringing you the news you rely on. Thanks. Later this hour in Here and Now, Chef Kathy Gunst prepares fiddlehead ferns. 61 degrees in Boston under mostly cloudy skies.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers from Car Talk.
And we're here to up the ante.
Right. I mean, normally when you pledge, you get something real exciting like a tote bag.
Oh, be still my heart.
Exactly what I think. But get this. If you pledge now, you'll be entered into a drawing for a 2003 Subaru Baja, courtesy of Cityside Subaru in Arlington.
Put that in your tote bag and smoke it.
Yeah, if you want to get the details, log on to WBUR.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, trouble tracing 9/11 calls from cell phones. In Philadelphia, dispatchers could only listen as a man was stabbed to death.
These types of tragedies occur on a regular basis, and it's completely unacceptable, and now, because of technology, unnecessary.
Also, should police put tracking devices on cars driven by crime suspects?
And a fiddlehead frenzy with Chef Kathy Gunst.
They resemble the head of a violin or a fiddle. They're bright green, and if you've never tried a fiddlehead fern, you're in for a great treat.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Non-essential U.S. diplomats are leaving Saudi Arabia as the death toll in a terrorist attack has climbed to 34, including at least 7 Americans. The U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia is criticizing the Saudi government for not taking concerns about terror attacks seriously enough. But the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud Al-Faisal, says the attacks will strengthen his government's resolve.
Whatever success they think they have achieved, they will be sorry for, because this country now is united against them in every way.
The prince says the attacks will bring the U.S. and Saudi Arabia closer. Nine Saudi suicide bombers are also believed to have died in the attacks. Villagers pulled body after body from a mass grave in central Iraq today, exhuming the remains of up to 3,000 people they suspect were killed during the 1991 Shiite revolt against Saddam Hussein's regime. Ahmad Shalabi, leader of the Iraqi National Congress, says more help is needed from the international community.
Where is Amnesty International? Where is Human Rights Watch? Where is the German Chancellor who tried to save Saddam from the war? Where is President Chirac? Where are all these people? We want this to be documented.
The mass grave, 60 miles south of Baghdad, is the largest found in Iraq since U.S. forces overthrew Saddam Hussein. Authorities in Texas have discovered the bodies of 18 people, believed to be illegal immigrants, in and around a trailer at a South Texas truck stop. Victoria County police found the bodies early this morning when they responded to a report of a disturbance. Authorities are still looking for others who were in the trailer and fled the scene. A man in charge of the Columbia shuttle investigation says NASA officials may have missed signals before the shuttle's crash in February. Retired Admiral Harold Gaiman told a Senate panel that NASA should have taken satellite images of possible damage to the shuttle before its descent, and a NASA official agreed they should have looked at the images. Sales in the nation's retailers were down by 0.1% last month. The drop in April sales came after shoppers splurged in March. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 36 points at 86.43. The Nasdaq is down 8 at 15.32. And the Standard & Poor's Index is off 4 points at 9.39. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a grocery store where shoppers will find a variety of foods and beverages, like artisan breads, heat-and-eat entrees, and a myriad of cheeses, TraderJoe's.com. Landry & Arcari, Oriental Rugs and Carpeting, offering a complimentary brochure filled with pictures and tips on buying rugs and carpeting, 800-649-5909. And Mississippi's. Mississippi's opened in Kenmore Square in 1977, moved to Brigham Circle in 1986, and found a permanent home in Roxbury Crossing in 1998. In the forecast, partly cloudy skies this afternoon, maybe a peak at the sun, highs around 63. Overnight, mostly cloudy in the 40s. Tomorrow, partly sunny, breezy, with a high near 60. Friday, mostly cloudy and cooler, and the weekend looks very promising. Partial sun on Saturday and beautiful on Sunday. Right now, 61 degrees in Boston. It's 1234.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Should technology that led police to a man who killed his own 9-year-old daughter be made available to law enforcement without a warrant? Washington State Police tracked William Bradley Jackson by attaching a GPS, a global positioning system device, to his truck. They did have a warrant. So when Jackson visited his child's shallow grave, police were able to arrest him. The question now before the Washington State Supreme Court is whether a warrant should always be necessary for police to use a GPS. To discuss the case and its privacy implications, we're joined now by Kevin Korsmo, who's a deputy prosecutor in the Spokane County Prosecutor's Office. Welcome, Kevin.
Hello there.
Kevin, why shouldn't police be able to use GPS even without a warrant?
Because what this device did was trail Mr. Bradley Jackson on the roads and highways of the state of Washington, the same thing a detective in a following car could have done. All this does is augment what anybody sitting on the street corner could see, which is where Brad Jackson's car just went. And he has no right of privacy in his travels on the public roads.
Yeah, but police were not following him on the public roads. They were following him electronically. There is a difference.
Not much of one. It's, you know, just the same as sitting there watching from six blocks away with binoculars or any other enhancement device of that along those lines.
Well, a very reprehensible character, and he has been convicted of killing his daughter, was captured in this case. But obviously, people worry about Big Brother.
That's understandable. But, you know, nothing in this case is going to change that situation. Right now, you could go put a GPS device on someone's car, and there's nothing that the Constitution can ever do about that. Washington has a far-reaching privacy act that prohibits wiretapping and the like, you know, much greater protection than is afforded by the constitutions of the United States. But to this point, the legislature has not seen fit to deal with the GPS tracking issue.
How do you expect the court to rule?
I have no guess on that whatsoever, but the only thing I'll guarantee is it will be a very lively debate.
Kevin Korsmo, thanks very much for your time.
Appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Thank you. Kevin Korsmo is a deputy prosecutor in the Spokane County Prosecutor's Office. We turn now to Doug Klunder, who's an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington State. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
Doug, your group filed a friend of the court brief in this case. What does it say?
It says that a warrant is necessary to install and use a GPS device, and that is under our state constitutional privacy protection.
I see. But this is a case where using a GPS device led to a good conclusion. However horrific the story, it led to the capture of a man who had murdered his daughter.
Yes, it did. And without a warrant, not only could the police install these devices at any time, but it would appear that the Court of Appeals also agrees that any private citizen can install devices at any time, and we're very concerned about the growth of a surveillance society, and we don't want the courts to sanction tracking of every individual at every moment of their life. We all know that technology is rapidly improving, and GPS capabilities are being built into almost every device now, certainly cell phones and the like. The cost is coming down, and it would open the door for tracking devices to be installed on an almost routine basis or be installed on vehicles of people where there's some level of not even real suspicion, but just, we think that guy's a shady character. And we don't want that kind of tracking of movements on a daily basis without reason, without suspicion, without probable cause.
Have other states grappled with this besides Washington?
We appear to be the first state where the use of a GPS device has actually gone before a court.
Doug Klunder, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Doug Klunder, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington State.
Well, the ability to track a person might have saved the life of Reynaldo Zayas. Last week, as kidnappers repeatedly stabbed Zayas, he twice called 911 from his cell phone, one of the calls lasting 18 excruciating minutes. But police dispatchers listening in Philadelphia were unable to save Zayas because he couldn't tell them where he was and they couldn't find him. Philadelphia, like most cities across the country, doesn't have the technology to track emergency calls made from cell phones. Well, joining us on the line is John Melcher. He's president of the National Emergency Number Association, speaking to us from Arlington, Virginia. John, tell us, how could this happen? A lot of people, I'm sure, think that a cell phone works like a regular phone and the call can be traced to an address.
Yes, another example of a tragedy, and these types of tragedies occur on a regular basis, and it's completely unacceptable, and now, because of technology, unnecessary.
I'm thinking of the New York boys who called on their cell phone from their sinking rowboat, and they drowned because rescuers couldn't find them. Almost all 911 centers around the country can pinpoint locations from a landline, but less than 5% can do that from a cell phone. So why is that?
It boils down to political will and funding, and we're hoping that where the political discipline comes in, the funding will follow.
Now, what would the political problems be?
Well, in many states wrestling with deficits, the 911 savings account that's been built up by a fee on the phones has been raided and diverted for other purposes, and now the dispatch community does not have enough money to upgrade their systems to accommodate this new technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that you are also, in addition to being with the National Emergency Number Association, you're the Deputy Director and Chief Operating Officer of the Greater Harris County 911 Service in Houston, Texas, where this new technology has been implemented. Have you seen it work?
Oh, absolutely. It's those times when the person can't tell you where they are and they're in desperate need of help and we can locate them and save their life.
I'm thinking of the elderly as well. Well, some might worry about privacy issues. You know, they don't want their whereabouts tracked and known and perhaps recorded by police. Do you have any concern about that?
Absolutely not. Not for 911. The system is not activated until you dial those magic three digits.
And any concern about keeping a record of the information of where someone is when they call 911?
All 911 call-related data is protected data and is only released through a subpoena or court order.
Well, John, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
John Melcher is president of the National Emergency Number Association.
Speaking of tracking people, Colombian President Alvaro Uribe is being tracked by a United States satellite, according to a Reuters news dispatch, to protect him from attacks by Marxist guerrillas. But a State Department spokesman we asked about this called the idea highly improbable to the point of absurdity. Well, improbable, too, the entire Reuters report, which concerned two thieves who got a hold of President Uribe's wallet after he dropped it. The president had his secret bank code on a note inside the wallet. Not smart, President Uribe. The thieves withdrew $4,200 from 32 different ATMs before they were caught. President Uribe got his money back and decided not to press charges. After all, his campaign slogan was, "Firm hand, big heart."
Still to come, coiled fern leaves, better known as fiddleheads, a seasonal delicacy prepared by Chef Kathy Gunst.
You're listening to Here and Now. For anyone out there whose teeth are set on edge by teenagers' teeth rotting because of all the soda they drink at school, well, the Boston Water and Sewer Commission has an idea how to wean a teen from sugary soda. The idea is to get the kids to drink water. Maybe not surprisingly for a Water and Sewer Commission, which came up with the idea, though the sewer part of all that may be something less than an inducement. In any event, the gimmick is to offer teens a really hip-looking bottle that they can then fill with tap water instead of pouring quarters down or sliding dollar bills into a soda machine. Well, joining us on the line from Boston is Tom Bagley, Manager of Community Services from the Water and Sewer Commission for the City of Boston. And welcome, Tom Bagley.
How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Who came up with the idea?
Actually, we sat around the table. We thought of the idea of classic Boston water bottle about 4 years ago. And we've actually gone through schools, brought these bottles to schools at different school events, and the students have really taken to it.
Classic Boston water bottle. What does it look like?
It's a typical 12-ounce classic clear plastic bottle with a light blue label on it with our logo on it, Boston Water and Sewer Commission, and it says classic Boston water on it.
And what kind of reaction are you getting?
Excellent reaction from the students. The students have really, like I said, the students have really taken to it. When they have events at schools, we actually bring the bottles with us and we talk about water and try to encourage them to drink water instead of soda.
Now, is there anything particularly seductive about Boston water?
Well, it's been around since the 1600s from different water sources since then. And we think we have the best water in the country.
Not at all prejudiced, being from the Boston Water
exactly.
And Sewer Commission. Tom, how's it going? Have you been able to put this in schools to an extent that you can tell whether kids are buying into this or not?
Actually, yes. During Drinking Water Week, we visited several schools in the Boston area, and they heard about we had a classic Boston water bottle for them, and they were very eager to accept this. And like I said, we're trying to encourage the children to drink the water. It's very healthy for them, and And it's been really taken off pretty well. We're very happy about it.
How do you feel about all the soda machines in Boston schools and schools all over the country?
Well, as you know, soda is often high in sodium, and long-term can increase the risk of developing different medical problems as opposed to water.
Water's the way to go if you're a kid, huh?
We really think so. And in Boston Water, we really encourage our students throughout the Boston area to drink the water.
Well, Tom Bagley, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
All the best with this. Right. Tom Bagley, Manager of Community Services from the Water and Sewer Commission for the City of Boston. But I love that dirty water. Oh, Boston, you're my home.
Oh, yeah. We had to do it. Well, as always, we want to hear your thoughts on anything on our program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Elizabeth Shameless. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And for more information on the program, visit our website, here-now.org.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the law firm of Yurko & Salveson, P.C., courtroom advocates for companies, professionals, and individuals in business litigation. Mark Christophe Interiors, working with architects and private clients to design approachable, comfortable, client-centered spaces. ChristopheInteriors.com. That's C-H-R-I-S-T-O-F-I, Interiors.com. And Picante Mexican Grill and Caterers, helping turn corporate and social occasions into fiestas. Catering menus at 617-576-6744. Come explore the countryside and distinctive cuisine of Tuscany and Umbria with Sylvia Poggioli on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. For more information, 800-909-9287. News from the BBC coming up next at 1 o'clock. 61 degrees and partly sunny in Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, every other Wednesday, we invite Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, to come in and prepare a seasonal dish for us. 2 weeks ago, it was soft-shell crabs, an item at its best this time of year, as are fiddlehead ferns. They're in season right now. Get them while you can, and they'll tug at your heartstrings as they do Kathy's. And by the way, as you're listening, check out our website, here-now.org, for recipes for soft-shell crabs and fiddlehead ferns.
Around this time of year, you may see strangers walking through the woods near riverbeds and marshes and small bodies of water, stooped over, looking very suspicious. Well, you don't need to worry. You don't need to call the America Homeland Office. What they're probably doing is foraging for fiddlehead ferns. Fiddlehead ferns are a true spring delicacy. They are young, edible, tightly coiled ferns, and they are only edible for a small period of time when they are tightly round up. And the way they got their name is because they resemble the head of a violin or a fiddle. They're bright green, and if you've never tried a fiddlehead fern, you're in for a great treat. Ferns are found primarily in the eastern half of the United States, say from Virginia up to Canada. They're found in the beginning of April, and the season goes for about 2 months, depending on the region. And the reason it's such a short season is that the minute the fiddlehead ferns begin to unfurl, they grow shoots and ferns, and they're no longer edible. So you should only eat a fiddlehead if it's very tightly coiled. Mm-hmm. Now, you may have one of these friends that does covet a field or a marsh, but what you'll find is that people that forage for fiddleheads will not tell you where they go. It's like mushroomers and truffle hunters. They're secrets. They're quiet places because they're so hard to find, and they tend to be very expensive. You can find them in supermarkets and specialty food stores, at vegetable stands. They're well worth seeking out, unless you, of course, know of a secret marsh. Lucky for fiddlehead lovers that they freeze easily. You'll also find them canned, and although I detest almost all canned vegetables, canned fiddleheads are not bad if you've got a craving in the middle of February. But right now, during this spring, is the time of year to take advantage of fresh fiddlehead ferns. Fiddlehead ferns, like so many seasonal foods, need to be treated very simply. To describe the taste is difficult. I've heard people talk about them as being very similar to asparagus. Some people compare them to okra or green beans. I myself think of them as a very wild asparagus-like flavor, and they have more of a crunch as long as you don't overcook them. What I'm going to do with the fiddlehead ferns today is I'm going to very briefly blanch them in boiling water, which just gives them an initial cooking, and then I'm going to put them in cold water immediately to stop that cooking and keep the green color. Then I'm going to drain them, and then I'm going to put them in a very hot skillet with very good olive oil and lots of fresh garlic and pepper. That's it. And it's a fabulous side dish all on its own. You can make soups with fiddleheads. You can do all sorts of things. But somehow the combination of olive oil and garlic and fiddleheads, to me, just sings out springtime. There's a few simple techniques for getting the fiddlehead fern ready. What you'll see, you want to look for a very bright green fiddlehead fern, and it's going to have this tightly coiled head, and then there'll be a little tail that spins out almost like a comet. The first thing you want to do is snip that off. You can use your hands or you can use a knife just to cut a little bit of the end. You'll see that it's brown there. So when you're looking for fiddlehead ferns, whether you're in the forest or whether you're at the grocery store or the vegetable stand, you want them tightly furled and bright green, but you also want to find them. They're going to have something called a brown scale on them. It almost looks like a papery skin on the outside. And what you want to do is just rub the fiddlehead in your hand to remove that brown skin. I'm gently rubbing it in my hand, and that brown skin comes right off, and then you just trim that little bit of brown tail off. It's actually a great technique. You can do two of them at a time. Just rub them in your hand very gently. I'm working with about a pound of fiddleheads, and I've got them trimmed, and I have that brown scale off. And I've got a pot of boiling water here ready to go. Before you put them into the boiling water, you want to have a bowl of cold water ready, because what you're going to do is you're going to immerse them in the boiling water. This is called blanching, and then you're going to immediately remove them with a slotted spoon into the cold water, and that stops the cooking, and it also retains the brilliant green color of the fiddlehead fern. So I'm going to take my fiddleheads. I've removed the brown skin, and I've removed that little bit of brown tail, and put them into the boiling water. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So they've been in 10 seconds, and I'm taking a slotted spoon, and I'm just putting them into a bowl of very cold water, which will stop that cooking. You can do this several hours before you're going to cook the fiddleheads if you're short on time or if it's part of a large dinner. The other thing you can look for this time of year is something called spring garlic. And what that is are the shoots off of new garlic that's been grown all winter long. With garlic, you plant it in the fall and it winters over. And you can take the top of the garlic, they often sell it, and it is called spring garlic, and it's got a fabulously subtle garlicky flavor. That would be delicious in this dish. Otherwise, I'm going to take about 3 or 4 cloves of garlic and finely chop them. Okay, I've got a large, heavy skillet here, and I'm going to get that a bit hot over moderately high heat. I'm going to add about a tablespoon, maybe a tablespoon and a half of olive oil. Use good olive oil. There's only 3 ingredients in this dish, and each one should really sing out. It should be of the highest quality. We're going to add our 2 to 3 cloves of chopped garlic. Now, we don't want to let this burn, so we're going to constantly be stirring the garlic in the olive oil just for about 10, 20 seconds until it just begins to turn golden, but don't let it burn. And then we have our fiddleheads, which have already been trimmed, and the skin has come off, and they've been very briefly blanched, but they're nice and cool. And we're going to throw those in. The only other ingredient this dish needs is a generous grinding of sea salt, if you have it, or salt and some pepper, and then you're going to taste spring. Good grinding of salt and pepper. Now, we only want to sauté these. Remember, they've already been blanched. They need to be crunchy. There's nothing worse than having a limp fiddlehead. If you've had asparagus that have been overcooked, you know exactly what I mean. It's not what the vegetable's about. So we want to cook them for about a minute and a half. You can taste one. It shouldn't taste raw, but it should have a good crisp bite. Give this a few more minutes, and then I'll give it a taste. Perfect. They're very earthy, but they're not overwhelming. They're just a wonderful treat for your mouth. It's as if after that long, hard winter, your whole mouth just wakes up and says, ah, spring.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wortley. Special thanks to Jordana Gustafson.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Lindsay Crudell, Marisa Francini, and Meleka Samdani.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
For
more of Kathy Gunst recipes, go to our website, here-now.org.
And do get into your radio and join us again Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBUR, our support.